Our second speaker tonight is Dr. Marc Hamel. And so he graduated from Concordia University in Montreal with a PhD in psychology in 2001. His interest in health psychology began in the late 1980s when he was one of the few clinicians working with persons living with HIV and AIDS. He first began working with people with cancer in the late 1990s when he was a PhD intern at the Harwa Hospital. Dr. Hamel joined the McGill University Health Center, the MUHC, in the palliative care unit team in 2001. In January 2008, Dr. Hamel was appointed clinical director of the MUHC psychosocial oncology program. And he has sat on national and provincial committees, including the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer's National Advisory Group on Psychosocial Standards and Guidelines. The acronym must be very interesting. And the Quebec Psychosocial Committee. So Dr. Hamel is the clinical director of the psychosocial oncology program at McGill University at the health cell, the MUHC. Welcome.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Merci beaucoup. It's always nice to come and do presentations, even though, like Dr. Loisel and I work in the same area, we rarely get to see each other except at these conferences. And I see some familiar faces in the conference room. So, thank you all for coming. I feel like a rock star with this microphone. I won't sing, trust me. And I will keep my water. I've inherited my grandfather's voice. Everybody who meets me the first time says, "You have a cold?" I say, "No, I don't. This is my natural voice." So hopefully it'll be fine. I'm a clinical psychologist, so I'll tell you a little bit what I do every day. Me and a group of team members, psychologists, a social worker does family and couples therapists, a psychiatrist, a clinical nurse specialist. We get about 700 referrals a year to our program for the MUHC. For 70% of patients who are living with cancer and 30% of family members. And every day I have two hats. I have the administrative hat, but I'm in my heart and in my day-to-day, I'm a psychologist. So what I've prepared for you today is give you a bit the psychology of survivorship. So what does it mean to someone who's living with cancer? So I prepared a little menu for you, for us to discuss, and hopefully we'll raise some questions. So the first thing I think we need to look at is what do we mean by survivorship? Now, there's not an agreeable definition per se, but everybody agrees that when we look at survivorship, this is what we mean. So an individual is considered a cancer survivor from the time of diagnosis through the balance of his or her life. Family members, and this is interesting, family members, friends, and caregivers are also impacted and thus are also included in this definition. So it's not just the patients themselves, but the family members as well. In our program, as I said, there's about 30% of the referrals are family members, and patients say to me, like most of them are men, "I don't have a problem, but my spouse does. He or she's the one that's having the hardest time dealing with this." So when we talk about survivorship, we also need to think about those that are close to the patients. Now, including this definition, we need to also think about, a lot of my patients say, "Well, I hate the word survivorship. I hate the word survivor. I'm not a survivor. It doesn't feel that it defines me." So like I said, not everybody agrees on the definition. So that's why I put here, others with metastatic cancer don't feel that the survivor label applies to them. C'est pas une bonne étiquette for them. Because they continue to live with cancer every day. Now, here's the message as a psychologist. It doesn't matter what label you use. Find your own word, your own meaning, whatever that is, and own that. In research, and we tend to use very similar terms for us to understand each other, but it doesn't mean necessarily that they're always a reflection of your own experience. Definitions are really important. For psychologists, we study words, we study meaning. We often hear, I've battled cancer. What does battling cancer mean? What does it really mean to you? What does it mean to the patient? What does it mean for family members? Inherent in that definition, and a lot of patients say that to me, well, I don't feel I'm battling cancer, because that means, am I going to win or am I going to lose? So there's an inherent feeling that I may not win this battle. So again, I invite you to choose your own metaphor, whatever that is. And I often do that for my patients. So, well, if battling doesn't work for you in terms of survivorship, what metaphor would you use? And often we spend time just talking about that so that you own that within yourself. So you don't always have to battle against cancer. Does that make sense to people? Yeah? Good. Now, as Dr. Loisel just said, I'm going to skip this. There's more and more survivors, and the percentage of survivors increase every year. And this is inherent because we have better prevention in terms of preventing cancer and preventing complications from cancer. There's also improved screening and earlier detection and improvements in cancer treatment. So all of this contributes to the number of survivors in cancer. So my first question when preparing this talk is, why talk about survivorship? Why have a public forum on that? Why is that so important? Now, there are some studies that indicate that while mood symptoms can decrease after the initial diagnosis, so after the state of shock, the patient's sense of well-being does not necessarily recover during that period. And many patients continue to report functional limitations. I'll talk a little bit about that. So what are the effects compared to individuals never diagnosed with cancer? A lot of the patients come to me after the treatments are done. I should be feeling okay. I should be happy. I should be thrilled. I should go back to work. I just can't do it. My spouse tells me, get over it. Go back to work. Everything's fine now. And that's often an experience that patients talk to me about. The fact of the matter is, it's not that simple. And then Dr. McLeod is someone I worked with at the Canadian, we love acronyms, CAPO, CPAC. I'll try to minimize that. But CAPO is the Canadian Association of Psychosocial Oncology. And Dr. McLeod was the president of that. And she said this at a meeting, and it really, really stuck with me. She says, living with cancer does not end with a clean bill of health. Right? Everything, physically, you're fine. For cancer survivors, their cancer experience continues. And that's what we're talking about in terms of when we speak of cancer survivorship. Another issue that's important is in terms of emotional distress. There's been a great, great, great change. If some of you are patients who are either treated at the Jewish or the MUHC or wherever, whatever medical clinic, I hope, and this is a bias of mine, I hope there's been you've noticed a change. More and more nurses, physicians, the medical team will ask, how are you feeling? What's your distress level? Now, we're more and more interested in not just your physical symptoms, but we're also interested in how you're doing, how you're coping, how you're handling certain issues around the cancer. And as Dr. Loisel said, we're studying this more and more. And what the percentage is saying to us, there's about 35 to 45% of cancer patients who experience significant emotional distress. Now, what we mean by that, emotional distress is a big word to mean depressive symptoms, excessive worry. I'll talk a little bit about that. But it's sufficient distress that warrants an intervention of some kind. Another study found that the prevalence of severe psychological distress was significantly higher among long-term cancer survivors than those never diagnosed with cancer. It was about the odds, we talk about odds ratio 1 to 4. So 5.6% versus 3%, almost double. So it is something important and true. We often talk in the literature about late effects. What are late effects? If you hear doctors or nurses talking about what are late effects, and this is the definition. There are side effects of cancer treatments that become apparent often after the treatment has ended. Patients always say, I'm so tired. Oh my God, I am so fatigued. I can't just get myself going. And they say, yes, well, have we explained to you that that may, the fatigue may continue even after the treatments have completed? No. I thought once the treatments are done, I should get back to normal. We know that's not the case. So there are true late effects. Dr. Loisel talked about breast cancer and osteosporosis. So there are late effects. I'll talk a little bit about that. I'm not a physician, but there are some late effects, physical. I'll focus more on the psychological. So cancer does, the cancer experience does not end once the treatments are done. So survivors have unique needs. So there are physical, psychological, and long, and or long-term effects of the cancer and its treatments. They can be severe, debilitating, and sometimes permanent. We know that at least 50% of cancer survivors suffer from late effects of cancer treatments, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Now, there was an interesting study that looked at, so we know that cancer survivors have certain needs, certain side effects or late effects after the treatments are done. And this study examined survivors of adult cancers. And the question they had was whether the patients themselves had a discussion with a member of the treating team about the effects, the psychosocial effects of cancer. So was there ever a discussion with a team member? What do you think the results were? Very little. So although we know that there are psychosocial effects after the treatments, it's rarely talked about. As I said earlier, we're starting more and more to talk, to ask people about their emotional distress, but we rarely really talk about what are the psychological or psychosocial ramifications of long-term survivors of cancer. And that we need to do more and more work on. So what are the common issues? So I've enumerated some of them. I'll just go through them. So of course, let's start with physical symptoms. So we know that in terms of survivorship issues, functional status can be affected. So unlike where the spouse would say, just go back to normal, go back to work, it's not as easy as we once believed. Energy fatigue tends to remain very low. Pain, we know that lymphedema for certain, for instance, breast cancer patients, neuropathy, common tingling, the feeling in the feet after chemo, that's a common side effects. Changes in body image. We tend to underestimate, I had someone a few months back who we prepared for him to go back to work. One of the biggest stressor for him is I don't look the same as I did when I left work to when I'm going back. And we tend not to think about that, but for him it was extremely difficult in terms of the look, le regard, the perception that he would receive from others. So that's a huge, huge stressor. Cognitive deficits. We've all heard of chemo fog, I'm assuming. Now, we need to understand and learn more and more exactly what chemo fog is. It's not just a chemo-related effect. We seem to suggest that anxiety can also play a fog in terms of cognition and memory, but we know that often a lot of people present attention problems, memory problems. That's a common physical side effect, fatigue. Is very, very common. And we know that, as, for instance, in breast cancer patients, as many as 34% of patients with breast cancer will report fatigue, even after many, many years at the end of treatment. Others suggest that it's about 30 to 40% in other types of cancer patients. So fatigue is a real issue. Another thing we often don't talk about is in terms of infertility. Dr. Loisel again talked about support groups for AYI, so adolescents, young adults. One of the things that they have to deal with before starting chemo is in terms of fertility issues. For some others, it's not an issue, but for others, it's a long-standing issue, right? So giving up, perhaps, being a biological father or mother, it's an important issue. Everything okay? Now I've talked about the physical, let's talk about social ramifications. So what are the social issues that cancer survivors have to deal with? Family and couple distress. Dr. Lewis, I was talking about her research. I'm very interested in family issues, very interested, and also how the cancer affects the couple, the family unit. I often say to the patients, cancer is not just your cancer, it's the family's cancer, right? This is not your fault. This is something that happens to you and to everyone around you. Someone got an email. It affects our roles in relationship, right? I had a man in my office, and this has always stuck on me, and he says, you know, Mark, the most difficult part for me is having my wife do the grass, the lawnmower. And to me, and he just broke down. He said, to me, to have her do that is the hardest thing for me. So the roles in the house change, right? Things change. So it's not just the tumor. It's not just fix the tumor, give me radiation therapy, chemotherapy. There's all these other things that are important. Sexuality and intimacy. Do you know how many men that I see, the doctors never ask them about sex? Never. It's like we don't talk about it. It doesn't exist. Women, it's the same thing. Because I'm a male therapist, people think that women don't talk to me about sex. But they do. If you ask, they will tell you. They'll talk to you about it. Sex, I say to everybody, sex is like a drive, right? It's as important as eating. Eating is a drive, right? So it's as important, and it's important. And not just sexuality, but intimacy. Especially we're talking about, you know, men with certain types of cancer and prostate cancer. It affects their identity as much as women with breast cancer or gynae cancers. Work-related issues. Returning to work, extremely stressful. When's the best time? Should I retire early or not? My family needs the income. I can't. The fatigue is there. The neuropathy is there. I can't do it. Work-related issues, another common issue and difficulty. And of course, finances. Oops. How am I doing for time? Spiritual. Again, another issue that we often don't talk about in terms of how does the cancer affect spirituality. Oftentimes when patients say to me they're very angry, who are you angry at? Or what are you angry at? Or you're angry at God or whatever God represents for you. But I'm going beyond here, not just in terms of institution, but in terms of your belief system. The belief that the world is supposed to be just. I've been a good person. I never did this, never did that. I always took care of my health. I'm young. I shouldn't be dealing with this. There's a great sense of anger. That's what I mean by spirituality. What your values, what you believe in has been completely shaken down because of the diagnosis. Living with uncertainty. I'm going to talk a little bit about fear of recurrence, because just that topic, we can spend a whole 2-3 hours on that. But as a society, we don't like uncertainty, do we? We need to know what's going to happen in the next minute, in the next day. And sometimes cancer is all about tolerating uncertainty. And that's really difficult for us to do. Now, psychologically, I talked about the fear of recurrence. I'll come back to that. But there are a lot of studies showing more and more that depressive symptoms and anxiety symptoms can occur often after treatments. Like I said to you earlier, oftentimes the referrals I get are not during treatments. Why not? Why would I get referrals after the treatments? Anyone would want to guess? Why would distress go up after treatments? Right. While I'm in treatment, I feel I'm under control. Something's being done. Right? We're doing something. When the treatment ends, I'm pretty much left on my own. That's when the worry goes up. That's when the anxiety shoots way up. And that's when the family say, well, everything's fine now. You don't think about it. So anxiety can go way up. Another thing that we often don't talk about, and if I were to write an article, this is something I would really focus on, is the survivor guilt. A lot of my patients have joined either CAN support, Hope and Cope, other types of groups, or they've met people during the treatment rooms. Where is so-and-so? How come so-and-so's not there anymore? There's often feelings of losing someone, a group member, for instance, or losing someone that you've met during treatments. That has an impact. And so oftentimes we carry that loss within us. So that's important. So let's look at depression and anxiety. So I'm a psychologist, of course, I'm going to focus on this. So these are the two common emotional reactions that we often treat or at least assess during cancer survivorship. And there was an interesting study by Mitchell who looked at depression and anxiety in long-term survivors. And so what he found was depression and anxiety were not that different in terms of the rate between patients with cancer and those with non-cancer. It was not that different. What is interesting, though, is that in terms of the prevalence of depression was 27% among cancer survivors, and those of the spouse was 26%. Isn't that interesting? Like they mimic each other. So it comes back to what I was telling earlier, that cancer is not just an individual's issue, but it's a family issue. And that was the interesting part. The other thing is nearly 18% of patients experience high levels of anxiety 2 to 10 years after the initial diagnosis. So the authors concluded that after diagnosis of cancer, increased rates of anxiety tend to persist with healthy controls, whereas increased rates of depression are less long-lasting. Basically what it says, first there's depression, then comes anxiety in terms of survivorship. So how do I know it's normal? How do I know what I'm feeling? Is it depression? Is it anxiety? How do I know what is normal? Psychologists, by the way, we hate the word normal. Don't ever say I'm normal. But what we mean by that, is it adaptive? Does it work for you or not? Well, let's just, for the sake of tonight, let's all agree on what is normal. So these are emotional signs. So I just wanted to give you a bit of an idea. We all feel this way, by the way, sometimes. It's the intensity of it. It's the persistence of it. If it's there all the time, if it doesn't go away. So these are some signs to look out for. A sense of being worried, anxious, blue, sad, that just doesn't go away. So it's not just a fleeting thing, it's there all the time. Emotional numbness. I don't feel anything. I used to feel joy, now I don't feel a thing. I don't laugh anymore. Feeling overwhelmed, out of control, irritable, angry. Notice as a society, it's much easier to deal with someone who cries than someone who's angry, right? Right, if someone cries, that we can console them. Someone who's angry, we tend to pull away. It's the same thing. It's the same underpinning. Sense of guilt, worthlessness, helplessness, hopelessness. There's no hope anymore. Difficulties concentrating, feeling scatterbrained, crying a lot, focusing on worries and problems. That's all you can think about. Can't think of anything good, just worrying about what's not going well. And I'm not talking about personality here. I'm talking about a shift in your way of being, in your way of thinking. Not being able to get a thought out of your mind. Fear recurrence. Someone told me the other day, I'm so tired of worrying about it coming back. I am so tired of it. Make it stop. That's what I'm talking about. Not being able to relax, not being able to enjoy things, eating, sex, socializing, seeing your family, finding yourself avoiding. Depressed people, when they're really depressed, they don't want to see anybody because they depress everybody, right? So they tend to isolate themselves. At the extreme is the wish that death would come, right? So that death would be a relief. So again, there's intensity, there's the wish to harm yourself, that's one extreme, and there's the wish that something would happen that would just make it stop. But it's the same principle. And worrying all the time, rumination. So that's the emotional signs, right? So you know the commercial about depression hurts everyone? That's what I'm talking about. But there's also some physical signs. So it's not just emotional, it's not just feeling sad or blue or worrying. There's some physical signs as well. So unintended weight gain or loss, not due to illness or treatment. So physically you feel it. You feel it in your bones. Insomnia. So can't sleep or just wanting to sleep all the time. And that's hard when you're feeling fatigue from chemo-related fatigue. Is it chemo-related or is it depression? And often I'll ask, you know, is it emotional or is it just physical? And I came up with a good question. Do you sleep to escape? If you sleep to escape, it's about depression. Racing heart, dry mouth, increased perspiration, upset stomach, diarrhea, that's the anxiety. Peace, the worrying, the extreme. Physically slowing down or fidgety, and the fatigue that just won't go away. So the fear of recurrence, I said I would talk very briefly about this because, as I said, we could spend the whole evening on this. It's said about 70% of survivors report high level of fear of cancer recurrence, which of course can cause enduring distress. It's precipitated by certain events. Next week, I'm going to get the results of my scan, right? I have a pain. It's now on this side as opposed to that side. So that can elicit anxiety, other physical symptoms. So oftentimes, it's just something that normally you wouldn't think about, you wouldn't worry about. But now that you've had the cancer experience, it just has a whole different meaning. So the person becomes hypervigilant. Any physical symptom, anything that's out of the ordinary, becomes worrisome. And there's a syndrome, it's called, I can never say this word in English, Damocles, thank you, what they said. And that's the fear. It's the, you know, it's like patients often say that something's hanging over my head, something's going to fall. So that's what we're referring to. And not having that all the time makes it very difficult to make decisions, because I don't want to plan in next year. What if I'm not there? I don't want to plan in 2 years. What if I'm not there? Right? So you prevent yourself from planning, from the joy of planning, in case. And it's always in case something bad happens. So what to do about depression and anxiety? So just focus on those two. How am I doing for time? Okay, let's go quick. So there's no quick recipe. This is just some ideas for you to take home with. The first thing is you have to know what we're talking about, right? So learn about your emotions. If you're feeling sad, what is sadness to you? So learn what it is. Men and women express things very differently. I don't want to do a gender thing here, but we express things very differently. And men in my office, my wife wants me to come and see you because she says I'm depressed. I'm not depressed. If you're not depressed, what would be, you'd say you have. I don't feel well. Okay, let's start with that. And more often than not, after the first session, God, this feels good. You want to come back? Yeah, I'll try it one more time. But talking about emotions is really important. So learn about what they are. Seek the help of a trained, licensed professional. That's what we do. I always say to my patients, I don't have the absolute truth. What I bring to you is years and years and years of other people's stories, of other people's survivors, their story. That's what I bring to you. I'm like an encyclopedia of that. Yes, I've studied. I bring that too. But when I say it's normal, I'm not trying to be nice. It's because I know it's normal. So get support from someone who knows what the experience is like. Get involved in a support group, whether it's Hope and Cope, Can Support, or other types of support group. There's really strength in numbers. There really is strength in numbers. Daily routine. There's what's called a third wave of therapies in psychology. Basically, the bottom line is, think about it. When you're depressed, what do you tend to do? You want to do less and less. And less, right? You want to stay in your house alone. You want no one to bother you. So you do the opposite. You do more and more and more, and depression tends to lift. It's called behavioral activation. Routines are really, really important. Sometimes I say to my patient, who are really depressed, you're going to get up, take a shower, and eat. Get dressed and eat. That is your goal for this week. What's the expression? The appetite comes, ça vient en mangeant, le petit vient en mangeant. Appetite comes while you eat. Something like that. Learning to relax. We are so stressed, my God. We're moving from, at the MUHC, we're moving. I'm very stressed right now. But we need to learn to relax. We learn to exercise a little bit more. Join yoga. There's more and more studies on the mindfulness. Anyone heard about mindfulness-based practice? So more and more studies on the benefits of that. Learn to relax in whatever way relax is for you, right? And hope, maintaining hope. I talked about spirituality. Whatever hope means to you, whatever feels your sense of hope. That is really, really important. There's always hope, even though it seems hopeless. There's always hope. And that's something that I bring a lot with my patients is, what is hopeful to you? What is still hopeful and meaningful to you? And that's it. Thank you.
tell you're listening. It's like when I'm teaching the med students and everything gets awfully quiet for 1 minute or two out of 50. Our third speaker tonight is Mrs. Hinda Goodman. She is the Survivor Program Coordinator for Hope and Cope. Hope and Cope, if you don't know, is a nonprofit organization that helps patients and their families cope with cancer. I think it's these, all of these agencies that are surrounding the patients and their family are extremely important in helping us to maintain some kind of a normal life. Thank you for being here.
Give us 2 seconds. Oh, so there's a little thing over there. Okay, I think I'm okay. Yeah, thank you. Good evening. After the shock of a cancer diagnosis and then finally finishing the many months of difficult treatments, patients are all faced with the same question, now what? How does one move forward after this life-altering experience? Are you the same person that you were before the word cancer applied to you? As one patient said to me, they prepared me for everything except for life after treatments. Given the fact that there are many thousands of Canadians asking themselves these crucial questions, Hope and Cope, a nonprofit cancer support and information program affiliated with the Jewish General Hospital, has set about establishing a series of programs and courses that address the important issue of cancer survivorship. Incorporating the mind, body, and spirit approach, Hope and Cope aims to help patients recover both physically and emotionally and give them the tools to move out of cancer land and discover their new normal. What I hope to discuss in the next few minutes are the challenges faced by survivors, provide you with the information on Hope and Cope survivorship program, and review our ongoing services. The challenges faced by survivors can be divided into four main categories: physical, financial, emotional, and social. By physical, I'm referring to the long-term or late side effects such as the inability to concentrate, weight gain, fatigue, neuropathy, lymphedema, heart and lung problems, pain, and sexual issues. The inability to concentrate, or chemo brain, as some call it, is a well-noticed side effect. Patients describe it as having memory lapses, having trouble concentrating, or having trouble remembering details. They often feel disorganized and cannot multitask. Weight gain. Chemotherapy can contribute to weight gain. People often tend to exercise less and are generally less active when taking treatment. They may eat more due to medication and, in some cases, boredom. Fluid retention and increased fatty tissue caused by steroid use can also increase weight gain. Fatigue is the most common side effect. The causes include the cancer itself, the cancer treatment, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgery, bone marrow transplant can all cause fatigue. Anemia. You may develop anemia if your treatment destroys too many of your healthy blood cells. Pain, emotions such as anxiety, stress, or depression can lead to fatigue. Lack of sleep, poor nutrition, certain medications, lack of exercise, hormonal changes. The degree of fatigue varies from person to person. It may be short-lived or it may last several months. Peripheral neuropathy is a type of nerve damage that can cause numbness, tingling pain, and muscle weakness. It can be caused or worsened by cancer and cancer treatment, as well as by other conditions. Lymphedema refers to the swelling that generally occurs in one or more of the arms or legs. It is most commonly caused by removal of or damage to your lymph nodes as part of the cancer treatment. It results from a blockage in your lymphatic system, which is part of your immune system. The blockage prevents lymph fluid from draining well, and the fluid therefore leads to the buildup leads to swelling. There's no cure for lymphedema, but it can be managed with early diagnosis and the proper care of the affected limb. Heart and lung problems are most often caused by certain chemotherapy agent and radiation therapy to the chest. Pain. Some people experience a lot of pain after treatment, while some have less or some have none. Everyone is different. The type of pain you may feel after cancer include pain or numbness in the hands or feet due to the injured nerves that were caused by the chemotherapy or the surgery. Scars that resulted from your operation may also cause you pain and some discomfort. Cancer treatment can cause a variety of sexual changes. Even though the causes may be different, surgery, treatment, hormone therapy, or radiation, the resulting problems experienced by patients are often the same. This is an important topic that is often minimized and should be discussed with the healthcare team. At the JGH, patients have access to a sex therapist and a psychologist who specialize in this area of concern. Financial concerns. Even though going through treatment for cancer can bring about financial problems, as many people are not able to work during their treatment. Treatment and medications are expensive, and even with insurance, there is often a copay. There are trips to the cancer center that add up in terms of the cost of gas and parking. You may also have had to pay for a wig, nutritional supplements, or even some medication. If you were a two-income family and you had to live with just one income for a while, you've had to make some major adjustments and may have some debts to deal with. Some survivors need to take early retirement or have used up a lot of their savings. Many financial questions can impede the survivor from moving forward. Emotional challenges. When you face your survivorship, you may confront many emotional concerns. These include fear, anxiety, anger, guilt, and the highs and lows. The fear of recurrence is common in cancer survivors. Even if things are going well, there is always a thought in the back of your mind that cancer may return. You might worry that every ache or pain is a sign of something worrisome. For most patients, these fears fade, but for many, they never completely disappear. Every time there's a test or a scan, these emotions can be revisited. As an active participant in your care, you need to develop ways to help you cope with your fear. Honesty, losing the guilt, and talking about these feelings can help. You can be open about your fears and perhaps even find a trusted professional or a trusted friend to share your concerns. You may also ask your doctor about what you can do to reduce your chance of a cancer recurrence. Anxiety is also common with survivors. You need to be on the lookout for depression or severe anxiety disorders and tell your doctor about your emotions. If needed, you can be referred to someone who can help you through talk therapy, medication, or both. Early diagnosis and prompt treatment are key. You may also become anxious as you feel the loss of your medical team. Patients often report feeling abandoned. I'm worrying about who is now the person in charge of my case now that my treatment has ended. Work with your team, go to your appointments, and ask the right questions. Make sure that you understand your follow-up test schedule and formulate a strategy. Having a plan and understanding your type of cancer and the treatments that you had will help to reduce some of your fears. Keep busy, get out of the house, and find activities that will take your mind off your fears. Take care of yourself in the best possible way. Anger, why did this happen? You may never know. Guilt, what did I do wrong? You probably did nothing wrong. The highs and lows. Cancer survivorship can be a roller coaster of emotions. There are times when you're so happy you survived and look forward to a wonderful future, and there are times when you only see the dark side of life. Some patients have told me that having cancer was the best thing that ever happened to them because they now know what's important to life, and some have a very negative outlook. The idea is to become patient active in your recovery and learn how to deal with and handle the changes that you may face. Patients need to take the time to acknowledge what they've been through and to understand all of their emotions. Don't feel you need to do everything at once. Take time for yourself. Try exercising, talking with other survivors, and find the time for the activities that you enjoy. Social. Social issues often arise once treatment ends. You may wonder, where do I belong? Are you still the same person? You may feel unable to fulfill the past roles that you once held. Even if you are resuming your previous roles, it may be under a different condition. You may no longer be able to do what you did before, nor in some cases may you even want to. Your social circle may have changed. Friends that you once had may no longer be in the picture. You may have developed new and more meaningful relationships during your journey. Some patients see this experience as the opportunity to focus on relationships that they find beneficial and to rid themselves of those that they feel are toxic. You may worry that people will always see you as a patient and not as a person. You may now be more self-conscious, especially if the surgery and or treatment have left you with some physical changes. Your relationships might suffer if you're not open about your concern. There are those who often retreat into their own little world as they feel that no one will understand. Many survivors report feeling lonely. They find it hard to relate to others. Time may be your best friend. Take the time to grieve what you have lost and make plans for the future. Connect with others who have lived the experience so as to normalize your feelings. Return to work after a cancer diagnosis is an important step. In some cases, especially with an early stage disease, the return is uncomplicated. However, when there has been a long absence and many side effects, the situation may have changed. So Hope and Cope, I think a lot of you know about it. We were founded in 1981 by Sheila Kussner. Our services are open to patients from any hospital. We have four sites, including three at the JGH, and one is our freestanding wellness center. And we have programs that help the patient and the family throughout the cancer journey. Now, our survivor-focused programs. So our programs cannot address all of the many potential side effects of cancer that impact on survivorship. We do have many different programs that allow you to take charge of your life after cancer. These include Brain Fog, which was a program that we give that it was developed by a neuropsychologist. It's an 8-week course filled with strategies and tricks on retraining your brain and learning how to manage brain fog. Take Charge of Your Life After Cancer is a full-day course that we offer 6 times a year. The courses are offered in French and English, and they're offered on the weekends. Family members are encouraged to attend so that they will better understand what their loved one has gone through. We have post-treatment support groups, which are discussion forums for issues that arise after treatment ends. These can certainly help to decrease the loneliness and normalize certain emotions. Stress reduction, we have relaxation and mindfulness meditation sessions that are given on a regular basis at the center. We have the Way to Go program for people who've gained weight during their treatments. We have a dietitian and an exercise specialist that help participants to lose the weight that they gained. As far as financial questions, we have volunteers that have prepared financial information packets that we can give to patients, and we also have professional on board who can help patients navigate the often complex system. Physical issues, as mentioned earlier, certain physical symptoms related to long-term side effects have an impact on the quality of life for survivors, and we have physical therapists that can help patients with the side effects. The therapist can help keep muscles strong, improve coordination and balance in those with the neuropathy, and we offer regular exercise sessions that help reduce pain, and these sessions also help with fatigue and improve strength and conditioning. And for lymphedema, our therapists provide education and an initial assessment. Peer support, speaking with someone who is many years past the end of their treatment can certainly help someone who is new to the world of survivorship. We have an active matching program where patients and volunteers are matched along lines of age, life stage, and language. We have general wellness program at our center. Aside from the programs that are directly focused on life after cancer, we offer general wellness programs that can be used anywhere along the illness trajectory, such as our nutrition classes, physical programs, creative programs, support groups, lectures, and our library. So nutrition, twice weekly classes highlight healthy eating, often based on budget menus. In this picture, you see one of our programs where we teach people how to cook with Ensure, people who need to put on weight. So we have twice a week at the center, we offer different classes, volunteers teach it, and patients love it. These are members of our REOP team. So they are physical therapists and kinesiologists, and they help to relieve some of the physical side effects faced by survivors, such as pain, neuropathy, fatigue, and balance issues. And they help patients develop healthy habits, healthy lifestyles through coaching, and help people to return to their baseline functioning. And we've got exercise, we have a gym at the Wellness Center, and we also have fun things like Zumba and Qigong and Tai Chi and dance. We have a creative program. You know, lots of times just sitting down with others and doing a simple art class is a wonderful way to connect with people and, you know, to reduce stress. We have our choir, because as somebody once said, you can't sing and cry at the same time. So we have a choir that meets weekly at the Wellness Center, and we do two sold-out concerts a year, and it's camaraderie, and it's a wonderful, healthy thing to do. And our support groups, we have over 20 different support groups. Some are centered on disease, some on different stages of life. We have our 70-plus group. We have parent support group. We have young adult groups. We have groups that are open. We have groups that are closed. We have our Think Smart, Live Well program, which is offered monthly and covers such topics as reframing negative thinking, goal setting, communication, spirituality. And we have our annual cancer survivor event, which is this year is going to be on June 16th, at starting at 6:30 at our Wellness Center. And we generally get a sold-out house of 250, 300 survivors, and we really celebrate survivorship. So how do you access us? It's very easy. We're open to anyone. You can just call. I mean, everything is free, other than we charge a small fee for some of the programs that cost us quite a bit of money, like our Way to Go or our Brain Fog. There's a very, very minimal, but everything else is free. We encourage family members to come, and we want people that are generally up to a year or two past treatment, but for our concentrator programs, however, many programs are open to anybody anytime, even a couple of years later. If there's a survivor who feels lonely, who has questions, who is anxious because they're waiting for some results or something, they're always welcome to come to us. So this is just some reading that I thought has, you know, good topics, good things, you know, to read up on for any survivors or professionals that work in the area. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So there's no reason to feel lonely. They have every program to help you. Our next speaker is not related to Marc Hamel, although her name is the same, Valérie Hamel. Typical of Quebec, you always find someone with the same name. So since 2006, Valérie Hamel has worked as a senior psychosocial support coordinator at the Canadian Cancer Society. She's a member of the survivorship team that has been validating the approach on planning life beyond cancer developed in the past 3 years at the Quebec Division of the Canadian Cancer Society. She's the senior coordinator of Cancer J'écoute, Psychosocial Support Service, Canadian Cancer Society. It's a pleasure to welcome you.
Good evening. No, I think that's going to be perfect. Is it okay like this? Yeah. Well, thanks for the invitation for this evening. I'm really delighted to be present here tonight to discuss survivorship and planning life beyond cancer. Well, since the year 2000, different cancer organizations in Australia, the UK, and the United States have developed new approaches on survivorship and planning life after cancer. And so we at the Psychosocial Support Service at the Canadian Cancer Society in the Quebec Division, we've decided to also tackle this important issue. And so we identified some of the most efficient approaches developed at the international level and applied it to the reality in Quebec. And so we developed a program called Planning Life Beyond Cancer in order to help inform and support cancer patients, their loved ones, as well as their coworkers, their friends, and the employers, and the healthcare professionals. So the goal of our program is to address the multiple challenges that these individuals might be facing in planning life beyond cancer, whether they are related to planning family and social life, work, or finances. And so here are the outline for the presentation. Obviously, I'm going to go really fast on the statistics because Dr. Loisel and Dr. Hamel have mentioned a few of them. And how we define also survivorship or the definition that we've adopted and how we perceive chronicity in cancer experience. And I'll address to you some of the challenges that our clients have encountered and have expressed to us during our, well, in our program. And what I thought I'd do is that I would present to you the services that we offer in our program, and also just to show you a history case, a case study, sorry, just so that it could you can conceptualize what we do at the Canadian Cancer Society in this program. And I'll finish this presentation with a picture that reveals how intricate life becomes when one receives a cancer diagnosis, and how we can alleviate the challenges that the patients, the caregivers, the healthcare professionals, and all the other parties involved in a cancer experience may face. And so as Dr. Loisel had mentioned earlier, and I wish I would have had the 2015 data, but they will be out on Wednesday, this Wednesday. But there's no drastic changes, but these are for 2014. And there is an increase of new cases of cancer every year due to the limited demographic growth and to an aging population, not because of an increased risk, not an increase in cancer risk. In this slide, the percentages indicate the five-year relative survival ratio for people diagnosed with cancer for each decade. So as you can tell, it's encouraging, because people diagnosed with cancer today have a better five-year relative survival than they did just even a decade ago. Today, according to La Direction Québécoise de Cancérologie, we estimate that close to 100,000 Quebecers are still alive 10 years after their cancer diagnosis, and that's a lot of people that may help, that may need help. And so, as Dr. Hamel had mentioned earlier, we also adopted this definition of survival, which is from the moment a person receives a cancer diagnosis until his or her death. And we adopted it because it highlights the importance on planning life beyond cancer as early as possible. Whether it's for the return to work or daily activities, but it's important that we plan it as soon as possible. These are the questions that we've been told by our clients. For sure, will I survive cancer is still one of the most common, if not the most common, questions that a cancer patient will be asking himself or herself. And as we have seen earlier, the likelihood of surviving cancer is higher than before. And with this new reality comes new questions related to the quality of life of cancer patients and their loved ones. And so, for sure, will I survive is still the most common question asked at this moment. But the questions we're facing now is, how will I survive? Will I still have a quality of life afterwards, after the treatments? What will there be? What will be my psychological, physical, and cognitive limitations? How can I improve my future life regardless of the treatment consequences? And for the future, how do I live my life? What should I do? Who can help me, and how can they help me in the future? And so what we have seen, for sure, treatments are more effective and successful, but they often come at a cost to the patient in terms of the short and long-term effects. And chronicity is known as a state lasting for a long period of time and or marked by frequent recurrence. But what we see is that a lack of medical information, a lack of resources, and lack of time, combined to an impaired understanding, can lead to precipitous decisions and chronic precarious situations. And so precipitous or ill-advised decisions or indecision can result in important difficulties for cancer patients and their families. It almost feels like a snowball effect, and we refer to it as decision-making chronicity. In French, I like it a little bit better, chronicité décisionnelle. And I usually say the opposite. There's always the right word in English, usually. But this one, I like it a little bit better in French. For example, when we talk about follow-up appointments for, let's say, 3 months or 6 months or 12 months after the end of treatments, it's not rare that patients will mention how anxious they feel, as Dr. Hamel had said, and how fearful they are of a possible recurrence. And for many, these medical appointments and these feelings become a chronic reality. Every time that they meet their doctors or their medical practitioner, this feeling comes over and over again. And so it becomes a chronic reality. So the word cancer is synonymous with survivorship and chronicity. Complex issues may arise due to a misunderstanding of the disease and this new reality. The impacts or chronic conditions are not only physical, but financial, social, and vocational, as we have seen earlier. Far too often, people express that they find it difficult to return to their previous work, to their previous professional and social activities. Their reinstatement or reintegration into the labor force remains a challenge for themselves, their coworkers, and their employers they work for. And as we all know, it does not affect only the patient, but it also impacts their acquaintances, their coworkers. And often, some people have said, you know, when I go back to work, some of my colleagues will say, oh, family, your vacation is over. Well, it was not vacation. People don't really understand the reality of people who had a cancer diagnosis. And so we invite cancer patients and their loved ones to reflect on their future and plan their life upstream so that they can make informed decisions on different aspects of their lives. What we have encountered, well, these issues are encountered by our clients that call us at Cancer J'écoute, and they are presented in order of priority from what we hear on our telephone coaching sessions, which I'll explain a little bit later. Financial burden, people will talk about, will have questions about insurance, about their decrease in income, mortgage loan, or even their payment for current accounts. How do I pay my phone bill? I don't have much money. The disease is costly. About the return to work, they're seeking for help for entry or re-entry into the workforce and strategies for the work maintenance. Because you can have a successful return to work, but to be able to maintain this job with the same advantages is also a very difficult task. In terms of physical and psychological effects, well, oftentimes we hear about chronic fatigue, chemo brain, lack of concentration, and any other limitations due to surgery and other treatments, as we have seen earlier. About chronic functional limitations, sometimes we will talk about the programs for reentry, for entry or reentry into the labor force. And about the indefinite or permanent disability, most of the cancer patients can reentry the workforce, but we tend to forget the ones that are unable to do so. And some people are still struggling at getting their physical condition recognized. And that's a major issue. And so at the Canadian Cancer Society, at the Quebec Division, we have telephone coaching sessions, which is a free and confidential service tailored to the patient's needs. The professionals will target and identify the potential problems or issues with the clients and refer them to the appropriate resources. Sometimes it's their medical team, psychologists, sometimes it'll be an accountant, if that's the case, maybe. We will also help them with the planning of an appointment or a discussion with their HR. And so we also make, we also use the tools that I will show you a little bit later. We develop also a Planning Life Beyond Cancer toolkit, which is a list of questions and a list of professional and advisors. So the list of questions was intended to help cancer patients plan their life more easily after a cancer diagnosis and assist them with concerns such as financial decision making, family, social, and professional matters. Either they need to stop working or if they can keep on working while during, during their treatments. How they return to work or if they undertake a career change. Planning Life Beyond Cancer, the list of professional and advisor, we wanted to guide them towards certain professionals, certain professionals that had different expertise. So sometimes it would be a lawyer in a lawyer, sorry, I'm gonna drink some water. A lawyer, sometimes it's a sex therapist also. It could be very diversified. The fact sheets are, they give answers to general questions and most frequent questions, general and most frequent questions, and they were created in a Q&A format. Our targeted audience is cancer patients, obviously, and their caregivers, but employers as well, their coworkers, and healthcare professionals. They're currently available in French only, but we're working on that to translate these fact sheets. And so some of the financial questions, just to give you an example, in terms of financial insecurity, some of the questions that we ask in these fact sheets is, I can no longer pay my bills, what can I do? In terms of insurance, they could be asking, what is a salary insurance? Or do I have an indefinite or permanent disability? My insurance company calls me on a regular basis. Is this normal? And so on. So we have different questions and answers on those fact sheets. So my goal here is to illustrate the way we work at the Canadian Cancer Society in the psychosocial support with our telephone coaching sessions with our clients. So this, in this case, we had a woman aged 53 who was diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer, at the end of 2012. And she gave us a call in March, the beginning of March 2014. And so she had gone, she had stopped working, and she had completed surgery, chemo, radiation, and hormone therapy. She was well informed of the side effects. She was a nurse. She was a nurse, so she was well informed, and her medical team explained, she said that her medical team really took care of her, explained all the side effects. And from 2012 to 2014, she did all her treatments, and the impact she had was the concentration impairment, physical fatigue. And so she decided to do some light exercises at the gym. She also did cognitive exercises, and she consulted a nutritionist as well. And so in 2014, in March, she received a letter from the insurance company saying that she and her medical practitioner had to come up with a date for a return to work. And so she was a little bit worried on managing the daily routine at work and how to structure the return to work. And she wasn't sure if her medical practitioner had all the tools, had all the information, and knew how to establish a date for her return to work. So what we did with her, what we do usually anyway, is to assess her needs. If she has physical, emotional challenges, if she has any financial concerns, any social difficulties. We will ask also what the resources are in place at the moment of the call. Are there any adequate resources to help her at the moment or in the future? And who can provide help? And so sometimes we'll ask if they have a human resources department at work. Do they have a union member? If they do have an employee assistance program, And sometimes we refer them to the Commission des Normes du Travail so that they would find a little bit, more information on their rights. And then what we do is we coach and we refer them to other professionals. Sometimes it's to their medical team. Sometimes it's to other expert, other advisors. And so what we did with this person is we asked if she, if the medical practitioner would know a little bit about her work. Well, obviously she's a nurse and we think that he might know what a nurse would do, but we can't presume that. So we help her describe a typical day at work, the number of working hours usually, what are her tasks, her responsibilities. Does she have to lift weights? And how heavy those weights are? Does she take breaks? Does she have access to flexible hours? So all these details that are very important in describing to the medical team. Sometimes it's to the oncologists, to the nurses. And so we also list all actions implemented in her daily routine to help regain her physical, cognitive, and psychological health, because it gives a good idea on what she can do during the day. And so we coach her on how to address this topic with her general practitioner using the list of questions. And we also helped her out with, she was napping in the morning, and so we started, we suggested that she could talk to a physiotherapist or a kinesiologist in order to, well, napping, in, just to stop napping during the day, to do it lesser and lesser in the week. And we also told her to regain a routine, to engage into a work routine. So having breakfast in the morning at the time that she would usually get up and have breakfast before going to work, and just to go and play in traffic. Well, playing in traffic for fun, I don't think nobody has fun when they go in traffic. But when you have a when you just ended your treatment and you don't practice going back to work, it could it's a major challenge. So this lady just had breakfast like she would usually do. She just ended in the traffic for 20 minutes and touched the door and was really happy because she didn't have to work that day, because it was a lot of stress just doing that routine. And so she implemented that a few times a week, and she was, it was like a mini camp, trying to prepare for work, for a progressive return to work. And so she discussed it with her doctor and came up with, together with a date for her return to work. In the best of all possible words, this conversation would have taken place several months before her actual return to work. And if we would have had time, a little bit more time, we would have probably referred her to a vocational rehabilitation program where they simulate professional tasks. It's as if you're doing, again, a mini camp for a progressive return to work. But we didn't have enough time with this woman. And so I come back with the challenges that patients and professionals also face. And how do we tackle these multiple challenges? When we know that many individuals, many professionals, many parties are involved in a cancer experience, well, we think that living well beyond cancer starts with planning life early, as early as possible after cancer diagnosis, in order to prevent or alleviate the impacts of chronicity. And some of the winning conditions for successful and long-lasting reentry are support and information, a good communication between the different parties involved in cancer experience, and what we think now also is referral to rehabilitation resources, whether it's physical or vocational. And we see that it's making a big difference for cancer patients who go through a program, a rehabilitation program, that is targeting vocational limitation. And so for patients, one of the challenges is to obtain more precise information and support so that they understand their situation and the trajectory of the disease, so that they can make a better decision along the way, and ask for consulting services in order to make informed decisions. And for employers and insurance companies, we also, it would be a good idea to understand the reality of cancer patients and the consequences of treatments. We know that there is a big gap in their knowledge. It would be good to gain knowledge through training and being supported at an organizational level, and obtaining tools that will facilitate the communication with the employee and learn how to accommodate the individual adequately. That's also a major challenge that they face. And so if you would like to obtain more information on how to plan life beyond cancer, you may reach us at this number. Please allow me to remind you that the program, the fact sheets anyway, are only available in French. And the program Planning Life Beyond Cancer is only available at the Quebec division. And the services are also free. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mrs. Hamel. I remember after my treatments that ended something like a Christmas, it took me about a month and a half before I had enough strength to go and do half day's work. And then slowly and surely, as a researcher, we're always very busy, right? And so by the summer, I was still working full days, but I would just get home and crash. And by September, I was sort of getting really depressed because I couldn't be myself anymore. Well, that was 14 years ago. I wish I could stop because I'm unstoppable. So you do regain your energy eventually. Okay. Finally, as you know, we always like to end our evenings with a cancer patient giving testimonial. Tonight we have the pleasure of welcoming Mr. William Brock, who is a senior partner at Davies, Ward, Phillips and Weinberg, a major Canadian law firm. He was diagnosed with AML in 2004 after his father had passed away from the same disease in 1997. He's firmly committed to giving back to cancer research and has done so over the past 10 years through different means, such as funding fellowships in research and the publications of Portraits of Hope, a photography book. You have the web pages indicated here. Mr. Brock has been awarded the Medal of Honor of the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Montreal, and he was also given the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal for his outstanding contribution to the community. Welcome, Mr. Brock. It's an honor to have you here.
I'm living proof that there is life after cancer. Not a diminished life, but a better life, a life that's more fulfilling, a life that's more energetic, and a life that's more meaningful. And I want to tell you my story, since I only have 10 minutes, and I plan to only use... Oh, okay, you guys are okay until about 11:30? You have babysitters? Okay. Call your babysitter, tell her you'll be late. So, you know, they say a picture's worth 1,000 words, so to try to save time, I'll show you 6 pictures. That's my father. His name is Hyman Brock. Sometimes I say that was my father, and then I think of my children. So I say that is my father. On September the 27th, 1997, I was driving to a hockey game, because I play hockey. And I called my father, and he said he had been to a doctor, and there was an anomaly with his blood, and he was going to the Vic the next day for some tests, and they didn't think it was very much, so I kind of forgot about it. I went to play hockey. I was in my office the next day. My mother called hysterical that my father had acute leukemia. And that was September the 28th, and he died on November 6th. And that was really, really difficult. 7 years later, almost to the day, September 21, 2004, I'm diagnosed with acute leukemia at about 11 o'clock in the morning. So some of you know what it's like. So what do? You search for normalcy. My son, Phil, was at Selwyn House School, and they had the Selwyn House Fall Barbecue on that day. So I went to the Selwyn House Fall Barbecue. Show the next slide, please. And believe it or not, a guy comes up to me and says, oh, I'm sorry, forgot one slide. In August 1997, a month before my father was diagnosed, I took that picture of my son with Phil. Phil was 2 years old. That's the last picture I have of my father with Phil. And as Phil grows up, he looks at the picture, and that's the last picture he has with his grandfather. So on September 21, 2004, 7 years later, I go to Selwyn House Barbecue, and someone comes up to me and says, how are you? And I hear myself say, I'm fine. It's like, well, it's a real moment. Like, no one knows. Like, I hardly know. And he takes a picture. And that's Phil and I. On September 21, 2004, 2-3 hours after I'm diagnosed with acute leukemia, and while I'm waiting for a phone call from the Jewish to go in for surgery to get a Broviac catheter, because according to my doctor, I'm really, 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 really sick. I look great, eh? I really look great. Imagine how great I look when I'm well. I kept that photo in my office for 10 years because every time I looked at it, I said to myself, that was almost the last photo Phil had with his father. In 2012, when I published my book, Portraits of Hope, they took a picture of Phil and I for the book. And I want to show you the next picture. If you want to know what survival looks like, it's the difference between the last picture and this picture. That's what survival looks like. But there's more, as they say on those info commercials. You know, there's more. We'll send you something else. In August of 2004, I was at my country house in Vermont, and I took a portrait of myself with my daughter, Julianne. Now, just down, okay. This is myself and Julianne in August of 2004. This picture and that picture are identical. It's a month before diagnosis with leukemia. This is the last picture for my book. This is the photo they took of myself with my daughter. And if you want to know what survival means, if you want to know what survival looks like for me, it's going from this to this. And in 2 days, I'm going to be at McGill for my daughter's graduation. And I am the luckiest guy in the tent. Do you know why I'm the luckiest guy in the tent? Because I realize how lucky I am to be in the tent. And that's an unbelievable gift. So, what have I learned? What can you learn? What can we learn? I don't watch television, but I read the New York Times every day, and there's been a lot about David Letterman and his retirement. So I thought what I would give you, I wrote them down. What's written down? How many things are written down? 10. Okay. There are 10 things I've learned. 5 things that we can understand, and 5 things we can do. Number 1, we can understand whether you've been diagnosed 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, or whether you'll be diagnosed in 2019 or 2022 or 2027. Life is fragile. I went from having the entire world as my horizon, in the middle of a great career with a great family and great friends and great sports and great everything, to being in a 10 by 15 foot isolation room with 6 weeks to live. That's how fast it happens. And when it happens, it's too late to realize it could have happened. So number one, life is fragile. Number two, life is important. Life is really, really, really important. It's too important to be squandered on things which are immaterial. It's too important to be squandered only on you. You've got to do things that are important. You've got to do things that are good. Three, you can't time life. And I'm not referring to the news magazines. What I'm referring to is you don't know what's going to happen and when it's going to happen. Don't say to yourself, I'll do that in a year, or I'll do that in 2 years, and I'll do it in 3 years, because you can never time what's going to happen. And that's really, really important. The fourth thing on my list of 10, I don't want to bugger it up, and this goes to what a lot of the other speakers talked about. This is really, really important. The person who bears the most responsibility for dealing with your illness is you. You are responsible. You have to be proactive. Even if you think you can't do it, go and get someone else to do it. The greatest enemy you have when you are sick is passivity. Is inaction. You really need to be proactive. You need to understand that. Make that part of your life. No one is going to care for you if you don't care for yourself.